Welcome to episode 145 of the Fredcast Cycling Podcast for February 20th, 2010. My name is David, and I'm a Fred. In this week's episode of the Fredcast, an international arrest warrant has been issued for Floyd Landis. Trek and Le Mans settle out of court. The LA Times says bike thefts are way up. New helmets should soon work like a synthetic scalp. Plus, a cyclist asks a judge for the right to ride naked. Following the news, we've got interviews with George Hincapie, Cadel Evans, Jeff Lauder, and John Lalonde from the BMC training camp. So sit back, relax. If you're riding your bike, hammer just a little bit harder, because here comes the Fredcast. Hey, fellow Freds, welcome back to the next episode of the Fredcast Cycling Podcast. Great to be back with you and great to be behind the microphone instead of sitting in an airplane seat. For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, obviously the Fredcast has been, well, not quite as consistent as I would like, and so if you'll give me a second, I'll explain. Obviously, I have a day job. The Fredcast does not pay the bills for me and my family. It is a passion. And a couple of pennies come in here and there from some great sponsors about whom you will hear in a few moments. But I've got a day job and I got a lot of responsibility and a lot of folks that I need to go out and visit. And I literally have been traveling nonstop. I'd like to say since the beginning of the year, but I would say almost since the beginning of last year. Last year, I put on more than 100,000 miles just on Delta Airlines alone in business travel. And this year so far, I've already put on over 20,000 miles. So for those of you who are wondering what's up with the Fredcast, am I pod fading? Am I going away? I'm not. But when you're traveling as much as I am, and as, for instance, last week, you are getting up at 4 o'clock every morning and not going to bed till after midnight every day, well, unfortunately, it gets a little bit tough to podcast. So bear with me. There's a lot of great cycling coming up and a lot of great cycling events, Sea Otter, Tour of California, and all sorts of other stuff in between and beyond. The Fredcast will be there, and I will still be your source for cycling news, information, reviews, products, and all the other stuff that you have gotten used to hearing me talk about. So just stay with it. And by the way, if you want to know what's going on in the meantime in my life and, of course, in the world of cycling, just follow me on Twitter. Twitter.com/Fredcast. I know there's a lot of you out there that are not on Twitter and not following along, and at least you'll know why it is that I'm not podcasting. So thanks for sticking with us. Thanks for staying subscribed, and thanks for telling your friends. And here's a great thing to tell your friends about, and that is our new sponsor whom we love, and that is Jensen USA. Now, go to JensenUSA.com/TheFredcast. And when you do, you're going to be introduced to a ton of great deals on cycling products, accessories, and clothing. Just some phenomenal deals that Jensen USA is able to negotiate with their suppliers and then pass along to you. Look, the economy's tough enough, but we know you want to go riding. We know you want to keep your bike up to date. But I mean, for instance, how about a carbon wing road bar from Easton, the EC70, all right? Awesome road handlebar for just $80. Go ahead and compare that price to what you can find virtually anywhere else, and I guarantee you, you're going to understand why Jensen USA is my favorite place to buy bike components. And by the way, yes, I do get sponsors here on the show, but I only use sponsors or accept sponsors whose products I believe in, and I believe in Jensen USA. But in order to make sure that Jensen USA continues to believe in the Fredcast and support the show that you all love, please go to JensenUSA.com/TheFredcast. That way they know that you heard about it here on the Fredcast, and then you will still get those great deals. Once again, it's JensenUSA.com/TheFredcast. We thank them so much for their support of the show, and we thank you for your support of our sponsors. Now, let's get to the show. Well, unless you've been under a rock for the last couple of days, you may have heard the name Floyd Landis pop up in the news yet again. All of us remember Floyd Landis, who a few years ago won the Tour de France, only to have his victory stripped away as a result of doping allegations, where it was alleged that Floyd had improperly, well, improperly, had used testosterone as a performance-enhancing drug, and as a result, he lost his victory, he lost his final yellow jersey, and lost his appeal as well. And you remember that that was the 2006 Tour de France. Well, just recently, a French judge issued an arrest warrant for Floyd Landis for allegedly, get this, hacking into a French anti-doping laboratory computer. The warrant was originally said to apply internationally, but a French court official has since clarified that it applies only to French territory. Now, we talked about this today on the Spokesman Cycling Roundtable podcast, so here's a plug for that. That's www.the-spokesmen.com. And we had Neil Brown on, you may recall, the former editor of Road Magazine. Neil's a friend of Floyd's. He and Floyd have been talking about this, and apparently there's no such thing as an international arrest warrant when it comes to these kinds of charges. Really, what Neil surmises, and you can listen to Neil in his own words on the Spokesman, but he's surmising that what's going on is the French are trying to keep Floyd simply from racing in their country, whether it's the Tour de France or any other event. They simply want to keep Floyd out of the country. Well, meanwhile, Floyd Landis himself was on Larry King earlier this week here on CNN in the United States. Larry, not necessarily showing his cycling knowledge and not asking very insightful questions, but the bottom line is Floyd did deny the charges against him. We also invited Arnie Baker, Floyd's coach and longtime advisor, to come on to the Spokesman. And while he didn't have time to come on today because Arnie is also alleged to have been involved in this alleged hacking, Arnie gave us a written statement saying, quote, months ago, I offered to be interviewed through the applicable U.S.-French Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty, and the French authorities have not done so, regardless of how the French choose to proceed because of renewed interest. I want to make it clear once again, I never hacked into and never helped or hired or asked anyone to hack into the French anti-doping computer system. So that seems pretty clear from Arnie. And of course, Floyd making pretty much the exact same refutation denial on the Larry King show. Meanwhile, you know, we talk about Twitter here on the show a lot because it really is sort of this up-and-coming international message delivery system. There was a Twitter account, and I say was, I want to emphasize the past tense, called The Real Floyd L. And a lot of people assumed that it was really Floyd Landis's Twitter account. A couple of days ago on that account, after these allegations came out, but before the Larry King interview, there was a very strongly worded, and I won't repeat it because there were a lot of four-letter words in it, it's very strongly worded tweet that came from The Real Floyd L on Twitter, basically lambasting the French anti-doping authorities, the USADA, the United States Anti-Doping Agency, Joe Papp, who we'll talk about in a moment, Pat McQuaid, Tyson Taggart, and you, basically telling you to go do something that you probably wouldn't want to do to yourself. Anyway, shortly after that tweet came out and it was widely retweeted in the cycling community, that account was disabled. Now, whether it was canceled by the person or persons behind the Real Floyd L Twitter stream, or whether it was canceled by Twitter themselves is unknown. Again, our friend Neil Brown is going to ask Floyd himself whether or not this was his account. If we find out, we'll let you know here and on the Spokesman, but a lot of Floyd Landis news coming out last week. Meanwhile, Joe Papp, who testified in the Floyd Landis case in 2007 in front of the United States Anti-Doping Agency, pled guilty on Wednesday to conspiracy to distribute human growth hormone and EPO that he imported from China. Now, Joe says that, or at least according to the allegations, that he earned more than $80,000 selling these substances from September 2006 through September 2007 to 187 customers, quote, including cyclists and other athletes throughout the United States and internationally. And that is according to Assistant U.S. Attorney Mary McKean Houghton. Unfortunately, we do not know who any of those 187 customers of Joe Papp's were because much of this case has been sealed by the court, possibly indicating that part of the plea was perhaps an arrangement with the government whereby Pat may get a lighter sentence in exchange for cooperating with them in bringing down some of his customers. We'll find out soon enough, however, because Pat faces up to 5 years in prison on each of the conspiracy charges, and he will be sentenced June 25th of 2010. And speaking of sealed court cases, Trek and Greg LeMond have finally settled their case just 1 month before their trial was due to start. Now, as you'll recall, both Greg LeMond and Trek started this dispute about 2 years ago to terminate the relationship between them. Some allege that it was because of LeMond's anger, if you will, about Trek's relationship with Lance Armstrong, but the official reason is that there were alleged, quote, multiple breaches of contract in Trek's licensing agreement using the LeMond brand name on various road bikes in the United States and elsewhere, of course. Unfortunately, however, much like in the Pap case, the settlement is made on confidential terms, but we do know that it was dismissed with prejudice by the United States District Court judge, and that means that this issue cannot be brought up in court again. However, it has been revealed by a number of sources that Trek will make a $200,000 donation to LeMond's 1in6.org charity, which supports adult victims of childhood sexual abuse. Speaking of Trek and Lance Armstrong, do you all remember that Livestrong under 23 development team bike that we mentioned that was stolen from Mellow Johnny's a while back? Well, that bike, worth more than $10,000, is now back at Mellow Johnny's in Austin after showing up, get this, at a flea market in, of all places, Guanajuato, Mexico. Yes, I've been there on business, believe it or not. The bike, as I mentioned, belongs to the Trek Livestrong under 23 development cycling team, and it was originally ridden by Trek team member Ryan Bauman. This was a 4-month case, and obviously whoever stole it decided to take it down to Mexico to sell it. Could you imagine walking into a flea market and finding this bike? Well, somebody obviously recognized it as they were walking around that flea market, told authorities, and it has now made its way back across the border to Austin, Texas. My big question, and if any of you know the answer to this, I would love to hear. I want to know how much it was being sold for at the flea market. For those of you who are cyclists in the city of Los Angeles, make sure you are locking your bikes up so that you don't find your bike in a flea market in Guanajuato, Mexico, or Irapuato, or any other place anywhere else in the world. Because according to a report in the Los Angeles Times last week, although crime is dropping in the city of Los Angeles, bike thefts are up 29% last year. According to the Los Angeles Times, nearly 2,000 bikes were reported stolen last year, and authorities believe the actual number of thefts was much higher because so many people simply don't report stolen bikes. According to the LAPD, they believe that the increase is due in part to more people using bikes to get around in some neighborhoods. Personally, though, I wonder whether it's simply an issue with the economy. On the other hand, if crime's going down elsewhere and only bike thefts are going up, well, then maybe it's simply because there are more bikes and therefore more opportunity. And perhaps if more people are using bikes, perhaps they're simply not locking them correctly. I know our friend Carlton Reed over on quickrelease.tv showed some videos of how easy it can be to steal a bike and how to properly lock a bike. And then, of course, our friend Donna Tosi, who used to be the brand manager over at Kryptonite Locks, would also tell you use a good lock and use it properly. Interestingly enough, LAPD detectives recently broke up a bike ring in downtown Los Angeles. They caught two men who were stealing bikes and then selling them on Craigslist. I love this part from the article. These two guys were found at a motel where they found bolt cutters, hacksaws, and a Mercedes-Benz equipped with a bike rack. So I guess bike thieves find that to be a fairly lucrative occupation. However, a couple of bike messengers decided to take a little vigilante justice when they caught two suspected bike thieves. They then stripped the boys, because they were teenage kids from a local Catholic high school, they stripped them down to their boxer shorts before taking their cell phones, backpacks, and clothes. According to Los Angeles Police Department Lieutenant Paul Vernon, quote, they meted out street justice. We don't condone street justice. They never threatened them, but they made it clear, don't mess with another person's property. This incident and the arrests are the tip of the iceberg when it comes to people stealing bicycles. And by the way, for those of you who are wondering what's one of the big hotspots in the city of Los Angeles for bike thieves, apparently the bike racks outside the Richard Reardon downtown LA library. So if you're going there with your bike, please make sure you lock it up properly. And you know what? I don't care where you live. Chances are, if you listen to the Fredcast, your bike is pretty important to you, whether you spent $100 on it or $10,000 on it. The last thing I want to hear is from any of you that your bikes were stolen. So please be careful, lock your bikes properly, and you'll be able to enjoy them for many years to come. Now, for those of you who do live in Southern California and like to commute to work, you're being invited to the grand openings of Bike Station Claremont and Bike Station Covina next Wednesday, February the 24th from 8 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. There will be ribbon cutting ceremonies, group bike rides, open houses with food, drinks, music, giveaways, and fun. This according to the press release from Mobis Transportation. Now, Bike Station Claremont and Bike Station Covina represent the first bicycle and alternative transportation center networks in the country. And according to the press release, they are a significant step for alternative transportation and an indication that, quote, Los Angeles leads the way in these developments. Bike Station Covina is a secure bike module that provides safe indoor bike parking and a bike repair valet service. Meanwhile, Bike Station Claremont provides a variety of amenities that make bicycling more secure and convenient, including secure bike parking, restrooms, retail accessory sales, and bike repair and rental services. The grand openings begin at Bike Station Claremont at 8 a.m. at the Claremont Depot, 200 West 1st Street. The ceremony will begin at 8:30, and visitors are then invited to join a group bike ride at 10 a.m. all the way to Bike Station Covina's grand opening, or guests can take the Metrolink train to Bike Station Covina. Bike Station Covina's grand opening will begin at 11 a.m. at the Covina Metrolink station at 600 North Citrus Avenue. All bike riders and VIPs are going to get a free lunch at Nick's Taste of Texas, compliments of the city of Covina. And the indie band Artichoke will perform. For more information, go to www.bikestation.com. Came across another press release in preparing for the show, something that I thought was very interesting and something I'm waiting to hear a little bit more about. But if you think about the bike helmet that we all wear, it is essentially polystyrene encased in a plastic shell, a hard plastic shell. And according to the press release that I read, if you think about it, if you should crash because of the way that the plastic will interact with the pavement on which you go down, the helmet will not help protect your head against a rotational injury, although it will help protect against a direct blow. According to this press release, in the next year or so, new bicycle helmets will be reduced that include what's called the Phillips Head Protection System. And when it's incorporated into a helmet, it provides what is called a synthetic scalp, so that when it's struck, it's able to move and thereby reduce the risk of serious rotational head injuries. Now, of course, for those of you who followed my videos from Interbike, the Interbike TV segments, you know that I visited a number of different helmet companies, none of whom were showing anything with a synthetic scalp. I'm going to be very interested, to see what these new helmets look like and to try them out. Of course, I am not volunteering to give them a crash test. Quick bit of professional cycling news for you. It's not the busiest time of year for professional cycling, but I will tell you that the Tour of Qatar, or Qatar, or Gutter, or however you say that, I struggle with that every year, just completed with Walter Mol from Holland taking final victory in the overall general classification. As far as stage results, Team Sky won the first stage, Geert Stuurs the second, Walter Mol took the third, fourth going to Francesco Cicci from Liquigas, fifth Tom Bonin from Quickstep, and the sixth and final stage was taken by Francesco Cicci from Team Liquigas. As far as the general classification, Walter Mol first. Geert Sturz took second, 35 seconds back. Tom Bonnet was a minute 45 back in third. Roger Kluge was 1 minute 59 seconds back in fourth place. Fifth, going to Marcus Burkhardt. Sixth, Danilo Napolitano. Seventh, Philippe Gilbert. Eighth, Francesco Cicci. Ninth, Heinrich Hausler. And 10th place, going to Stuart O'Grady from Team Saxo Bank. There are lots of great cycling events on the horizon in March. Of course, the Tour of Oman going on right now, but coming up in March, as far as UCI events, Paris-Nice, March 7th through the 15th, Tirreno-Adriatico from March 10th through the 16th, Milan-San Remo on March 20th, Volta Ciclista a Catalunya, March 22nd through the 28th, and Ghent-Wevelgem on March 28th as well. For those of you who are wondering what Lance Armstrong is up to, rumors are that he will be racing Criterium International, Cape Argus, and Milan-San Remo, just to name a few of a couple of the big upcoming events. And for those of you who are looking forward to May's Tour of California, and perhaps for those of you who maybe haven't been keeping abreast of the news and wondering why it is that we're not talking about the Tour of California in February, yes, the Tour of California was moved to May, and yes, it does coincide with portions of the Giro d'Italia, but while the Giro d'Italia announced its route many, many months ago, and while, of course, the Tour de France has already announced its route, the Tour of California only last week announced the final details of the route for this year's Amgen Tour of California. For more info on that, I've put a link in the show notes to where you can get all of the information. And I got to tell you, the Pasadena to Big Bear stage looks epic. Go ahead and check it out. There are links in the show notes. Yet another story coming out of Southern California, and I'm not quite sure what to make out of this one, but do you remember when you were a kid and maybe you rode a BMX bike or some other kind of bike, and then on the back you had buddy pegs, and that allowed a friend to ride along behind you on your bike, and then there was some place for him or her to put their feet. We called them buddy pegs. I'm not sure what you called them where you grew up, but that's what we call them, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. Well, back in 2007, Los Angeles police stopped a 14-year-old bike rider one day because he wasn't wearing a helmet, because in California, kids under 18 have to wear a bicycle helmet. When they did stop this young man, the officer found that the young man had a buddy peg or bike footrest, which is made out of metal, in his pocket. And since he determined that it didn't fit anywhere on the kid's bike, he decided that this cylinder made out of metal, about 4.5 inches long and about 1.5 inches in diameter, must have been a weapon. As a result, this 14-year-old was charged with illegal possession of metal knuckles. And then a juvenile court judge said that he carried the device as a weapon, and then an appeals court eventually agreed. Well, just last week, the California Supreme Court unanimously overruled the two lower courts, deciding that bicycle footrests are not illegal metal knuckles and that state law does not prohibit people from carrying them. Interestingly, they compared buddy pegs or carrying buddy pegs to carrying a handbag, a lady's handbag. For instance, they said, quote, metal knuckles of the usual sort, which are fitted to the hand, generally with holes for the fingers, are worn in or on the hand. But a metal cylinder, like the footrests in this case, are not, in ordinary usage, said to be worn when held in the hand. Apparently, California Attorney General and former Governor Jerry Brown's office argued in favor of prosecuting the young man, and they compared these footrests, to clutch purses, which the fashion industry says are, quote, worn in the hand. And that's where this distinction came about. So for those of you who've got kids who are riding around the streets of California and they're prone to taking their buddy pegs off their bike, they can indeed put them in their pocket. They will not be charged with a crime. However, the way I look at this is these are metal cylinders. If they didn't fit on the young man's bike, why was he carrying them around in the first place? I'll leave that to your imagination. And finally, there are some stories which I have to read to you verbatim. And that's what I'm going to do with this one. A 40-year-old New Zealand man has asked the High Court to rule that it is okay to ride a bicycle naked on a public road. Nick Lowe, a Wellington builder, appealed to the court against a $200 New Zealand fine and conviction for offensive behavior, saying there was evidence that New Zealanders had become more tolerant toward nudity. Lowe is reported as saying there was nothing offensive about his ride on a quiet rural road in Upper Hutt, 32 kilometers north of Wellington, on last year's World Nude Bike Day. He was charged after a passing motorist objected and called police. Quote, "It's a lifestyle thing," Lowe said. "To put clothes on is uncomfortable. It's not about exhibitionism. I'm just uncomfortable in clothes. I walk around the house naked. I mow the lawn naked. I'll do the garden naked. A lot of smelly, sweaty clothes. Why do that when you don't need to?" Lowe cited nudity in street parades, National Nude Day, Naked Wedding Day, and a recent naked cycle on the Central Otago Rail Trail as proof that, quote, "we're not as Puritan as we used to be." He described himself as a, you can't make this stuff up, he described himself as a natural athlete, saying he regularly trained nude and had completed a coast-to-coast triathlon naked from the waist down and nobody had complained. Now, personally, this is where I've stopped reading, of course, I've never ridden my bike naked, but it just seems like it would be awfully uncomfortable, doesn't it? And with that quirky story, I will end the news for this episode of the Fredcast Cycling Podcast. Now, before we get on to today's features, just a couple of things I want to mention to you. Number one, we've talked to you about our upcoming tour of the French Alps, August 21st through the 28th. And you'll recall that we had our tour coordinator, Jennifer Sage from Viva Travels, as well as Tyler Hamilton on a recent show. Tyler's found that he's got some time constraints that will not allow him to go on this tour. Instead, he will be going on another of Jennifer's tours. He's going to be joining her and her tour attendees at this year's Tour de France. And by the way, if you decide that you'd like to go on that tour and you let Jennifer know that you heard about it here on the Fredcast, I would greatly appreciate it. But Tyler is not going to be able to make it in August. We regret that he's not going to be able to be there, but his departure is actually your gain. And for those of you who have already signed up, you're going to gain as well. And that is because we have decided to discount the trip for you in order to bring the price down. Now the price for this amazing 8-day tour is just $4,350. And by the way, if you pay by check, Jennifer gives you a nice $150 discount. Now, a $1,500 deposit is required at the time of registration. We're limiting this to a total of 22 guests, and the balance of your payments is due on May the 1st. If you don't remember what we're doing or where we're going, let me give you just a little bit of a taste. This is going to be an incredible tour. We're calling this the Coal Seekers, the Chasseurs de Coal, excuse my butchering of the French language. We're going to be climbing, well, you have the opportunity to climb up to 13 of the most famous cols of the Tour de France, including the Col de la Colombière, the Col de Aravis, Col de la Coiffure, Col de la Four Claws, Col de Tamier, Cormet du Roseland, Col de Pré, Col de Madeleine, Col du Telegraph, my favorite, Col du Galibier, Les Deux Alpes, Col de la Croix de Fer, and yes, the Alpe d'Huez. You have the potential of riding over 34,000 feet of climbing in 7 days, but don't worry, because you don't have to do every foot of climbing. You don't have to do every kilometer of riding. We have a great support staff and a wonderful support van. So when you need it, you'll be able to get into it. And yes, most days we do have options for riding. It's going to be an amazing week of riding over great mountain roads. And yeah, the roads in France are fantastic, and the drivers in France are really cognizant of cyclists on the road, and you're going to see some breathtaking alpine scenery. In the evenings, we're going to have some fantastic hotels and chateaus, including a great 4-star hotel at the beginning of the trip at Lake Annecy, right on the lake. It's a gorgeous location and a beautiful hotel, and then a chateau at the end just outside our departure city of Grenoble. This is going to be a great trip. We still do need to get some people signed up so that we can make sure this one goes this year, but don't delay. Sign up today. go to vivatravels.com, go to www.thefredcast.com, sign up today, or call Jennifer directly at 1-866-804-VELO. That's 866-804-8356. And as I said, even if you don't go on our trip and you want to go on one of Jennifer's other trips, please let her know you heard about it here on the Fredcast. As I keep saying, I can't wait to ride with you in France in August. And one more quick mention before we get to today's features, and that is while you're training for the Chasseur de Col trip in France, or as you're training for whatever it is you're working on as far as your cycling goals, go over to epicplanet.tv/Fredcast_bundle to get a $20 savings on a great package of two DVDs. It's the Fredcast Epic Tucson Bundle. You'll get Epic Tucson, and you will get Mount Lemmon and Saguaro East for a total of $39.95, and that is a $20 savings off the regular price. That's epicplanet.tv/Fredcast_bundle. Get your savings today. This actually is the ride I did last night on my CompuTrainer, and I had the benefit of being able to try out Epic Ride's new power profiles, which couples the CompuTrainer with your Epic Tucson and all of your other Epic DVDs and gives you the opportunity to simulate the ride completely. I found it to be a great companion to the Epic Rides DVDs. I know you will too. Go to epicplanet.tv/Fredcast_bundle to get your savings today. Every year in the fall and early winter, we wait to see what sort of changes and shakeups are going to occur in the rosters of the professional cycling teams. And perhaps one of the biggest surprises, perhaps one of the biggest pleasant surprises for a lot of folks this year, were some of the changes that were made in the BMC racing team. Now, Team BMC is an American-based team. Their title sponsor, of course, is BMC Racing, a Swiss-based bicycle manufacturer. The team is managed by Gavin Chilcott, and the director sportif is John Lelong. What was so surprising, pleasantly surprising, about the changes this year? Well, that they had signed, in addition to what was already a strong team, they signed U.S. Road Race champion George Hincapie, world champion Cadel Evans, former world champion Alessandro Bayon, and some of the specialists and some of the best riders in the spring classics, Karsten Kroon and Marcus Burkhardt. Oh yes, and let's not forget U.S. phenom Jeff Lauder, former winner of the Tour of Utah. Team BMC recently held a training camp in Agoura, California, and through the resources of Bicycle.net, we were able to get a number of interviews with some of those names that I just mentioned, including director sportif John Lelong, Jeff Lauder, U.S. champion George Hincapie, and world champion Cadel Evans. Now, before we get into these interviews, let me just warn you, this was a room that those of us on audio call live. It was extremely crowded and extremely loud simply because of the acoustics in the room. So while some of the audio isn't quite perfect, and while we did try to clean it up as best as we can, we still thought that we'd want to bring all of this audio to you because it brings a little bit of insight into the workings of a professional team, into the workings of a team that is really on the rise, and also brings you, in their own words, some comments and some answers to some questions that many of you have had about this team and about professional racing in general. So we'll start with director sportif John Lelong. Our first question to John was one that a lot of people have been wondering this year. You know, a lot of folks have watched the team progress, and a lot of people have wondered whether or not they'd ever get to the stage that they're at. I mean, having a U.S. champion and a world champion on the same team and a former world champion, they've really come a long way. And we wanted John to take us through, in his own words, that progression.
Yeah, I think that you have to seriously think about the last 2 years when we got the pro continental status and the wildcard status, which was the first step into international pro racing. 2008 and 2000, 9 were the 2 years of discovery, trying to test the best American riders, the best Swiss riders, to see a little bit who at the level to follow the adventure. But it's clear that when you have a vision, and that's the case with Andy Ruiz, with Jim Okovic, when you have a vision, you know where you wanted to go. And of course, in cycling, you wanted to go to the most important races, the historical races. So on the one day classics, it's Milan-San Remo, Flanders, Roubaix, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, Amstel. Those are the races where, yeah, there is a long history, there is a long attraction for the cyclists to be there. And on the big tours, we know that the most important one is the Tour de France. Then after, you have the Giro, you have the one-week stage races like Romandy, Swiss, Dauphiné, California. Those are a little bit the thing, but when you have a vision, I think it's more easy to work in this kind of philosophy, because you know that, okay, you need to progress every year, and you know where you want to go, you know with who you want to go, and then when you can fix this, you know exactly that you need it of that kind of riders. Is it Balan? Is it Hincapie? Is it Burkhardt? Is it Krohn? Is it Cadel? And then once you have those riders, you need teammates, good teammates. Teammates that you are formed by yourself in the last 2 years, young guys who have the potential to go there, or then to find the good teammates around the world. But yeah, I'm not too surprised about where we are, and I think that of course, I think that Andy Ruiz and Jim Okovic have a clear vision for what is the team and what is the future of the team.
Next up, we asked John to explain to us what it means to have these big riders on the team, and whether or not it changes the team's tactics and also the outlook for the future for the team.
We don't have the pressure of the race. I think that we try to have always pleasure and fun in the race. That's the most important for the whole group. We did like this in the last couple of years, and we will follow like this. But the most important when you have big leaders like this, I think it's to be clear in the tactic, to be clear in the vision that we have, to be clear in the objective that we have. We know exactly what are our objective, that's important. And then to be confident in the team and to do what is needed from now on, but also from October, to be sure that we have fixed all the details, preparation, training, selection of the riders, travel, selection of the races, the good calendar. But on the team tactics, of course, it will change a little bit, on the strategy also. But I'm pretty confident that we have a strong group of experienced riders, a strong group of young riders, and that this team is a good mix. Is it for the classic side, or is it for the stage races side?
Considering the roster that John and the others have put together for the team, we were curious to know, what are some of the marquee races for Team BMC to target in 2010?
I think that by respect for the public, you try to be competitive in every race. If you are going for an organizer, even if it is a small race, it's a race. So you need, by respect for the sponsor, by respect for the public, by respect for the media, and by respect by the organizer, you need to show up there with a strategy. But maybe not with the big leaders. But maybe that the young, talented guys will have their chance there. Why not? But yeah, we are more looking to all the races from the world calendar. That's the main objective. So it means all the Pro Tour races where we'll be candidate, and all the world classification races, the historical races, that will be the main aspect. And if I have to put some of them, it's of course on the stage races, the big stage races, Giro and Tour, that's sure. On the other stage races is California, which is really important. It's not a Pro Tour race this year, it will become next year, but we already consider it as a Pro Tour race on the same field. And then on the one-day racing, we will be focusing more on the historical races like Milan-San Remo, Paris-Roubaix, Tour of Flanders, Gent-Wevelgem, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, Amstel, Flèche. Those are the one-day races where we wanted to be competitive.
I think one of the biggest questions for a lot of the directeur sportif and team managers this year will be about the controversy about whether they can or cannot use race radios. And we wanted to know what John's opinion was of the use of race radios.
I think there is advantage and disadvantage on all the products. But yeah, I have never worked without radios, so it's difficult for me to say what was happening before. But of course, I use the radio. in the team car. Not so much, mostly for giving information to my rider to speak with them, not to change or not to to jump on all the attacks, surely not, and it's not a stressful radio. You can ask the riders who are with me in Australia, and it's more something that I use for information, just to remain them informed about what's happening, what is the wind situation, when is the next curve, what is the next climb and so on, who is in the break, who are the teams who are not in the break and that we can expect will be chasing in a few moments. So it's really an important mean of communication for me between me in the team car and the radio. And also, you know, the roads like now, on those big races where there is a lot of public, a lot of cars, a lot of TV, a lot of no roundabouts and some special management of the roads, it's more and more difficult to go with a team car in the group and to speak to your riders. But the radio doesn't change a lot in the strategy that we fix in the briefing. Once the briefing is clear, is it in the morning or the day before, once I have seen all the riders one by one before making my briefing and before making my opinion about the strategy, I think that once we have done our briefing, all the riders, is it the experienced one or the young one, they know exactly what is our objective for the next race or for the next stage. So they know what they have to do. After this, the radio is just a kind of information for me.
And finally, with the controversy that occurred last year between Alberto Contador and Lance Armstrong and everything that was swirling around it, we wanted to know from John's perspective, if something like that occurred again in professional cycling this year, would it be something of which he could take advantage and then use that for the betterment of Team BMC?
No, I think that we normally, like I said before, once I have done my strategy, I keep my strategy. I think that we are pretty clear on that and we don't have to change it. So I will not play the game to answer to other teams or to make my strategy in function of what the other teams are making. I think that we are pretty clear. The most important for us is that we know what is our final objective. In the classics, in the tour, in every race, we know exactly where we want to go. It's being competitive and doing the best job together for the whole team. So once we know this and once we have done the briefing the day before with all the leaders and all the teammates and that everybody knows exactly what he has to do, those are really experienced riders. Is it the really good experienced riders like George? If you look at his history on the tour, on the classics, he know everything. Is it Cadel? But also the young ones. They have already worked with me for 2 years, so they know what I mean, what I need, what I ask for. So I don't have to be there always to say, hey guys, you have to do this, 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 and this. No, after, once the briefing and the vision is done, there is a part which is also their own responsibility. And they are the first one to see what is happening in the field, because when I am in the car, I'm behind the field, maybe in position 10 or 15, I don't see what is happening. I don't feel what is happening. When you are in the pack, you can feel that, yeah, this team is maybe preparing something. Or there, take care, because there will be a wind blowing from the right. I can tell them this. Looking to my map, there is a curve. In 3 kilometers, we turn right, the wind will be changing. But from time to time, the map is not so precise. So those guys, they feel it directly. So I stay on the contact, on permanent contact with them, so that they can also interact with me, but they have to take also their own responsibility, and they do it without any problem.
From Jean Lelong, we went to talk to Jeff Lauder. This is one of those ones where the audio is not perfect, but I thought that Jeff had some great comments that I thought that you would find very interesting. And the first question was about his training vis-a-vis the Tour of California and also the possibility of doing a grand tour like the Giro d'Italia later in the year. Never doing a 3-week event before, what were some of his ideas about how the training would go?
Yeah, just hope for the best, really. For the winter, I've just tried to add a lot of hours, kind of coming in pretty slow relative to the last few years, trying to get ready for Tour of California, you know, knowing that my focus is later in the year, I've been able to, you know, back off on the intensity and really up to just the duration. So hopefully that'll give me a bit more base and give me better recovery down the line. Still definitely have a lot of work to do at this point, but I think just adding hours, you know, just riding the bike and getting more and more efficient over the winter, I think is going to kind of be the strength that I'll need to get. much. You know, 3 weeks is a long time, but you can only be so prepared, you know. So I think I just have to go into it and see what happens.
And considering that Jeff was going to be looking at the Giro d'Italia, and the Giro d'Italia this year definitely favoring the climbers, had Jeff added additional climbing to his training regimen?
Not yet, but definitely all the races I'm going to do in preparation, or not all, but there's going to be a lot of good racing with climbing. And moving the family, I'm moving to Girona, Spain for the early part of the season, so I think from what I hear, there's a lot of good riding there, and hopefully I can, you know, climb a lot and also ride with a lot of good climbers.
Shifting gears to the BMC of 2010, we wanted to know, what's it like to have been on the team for so long and then to watch it make this big jump to include guys like Hincapie and Cadel Evans?
Yeah, it's definitely been really exciting. You know, it's kind of fun to just see these guys get signed. And then when Cadel got signed, that was, you know, when the announcement got made, it was really, you know, it was quite a shock, and definitely really kind of just laid it all out for all of us. You know, they've always been talking, you know, like big things to come, and you know, ever since the team started, when I came to the team, I mean, I guess it had already been in existence, but you really could see the infrastructure and the way that the team was being managed, and the way that, you know, like bringing on John Lalonde early on, and you know, even hiring, you know, riders like Marcus Berg and stuff like that. It's like you could really just sense that the team was kind of destined for greater things than, you know, where we were. So in the end, as it's happening, it's kind of, you don't want to say like destiny, but it seemed like it was like you could always kind of see the writing on the wall that this was what was going to happen. You know, and as a rider, start a race until you pin your numbers on, and you're on the start line, because so many things can go wrong. But just the way that this team, just the way the team was built and structured, you could just tell that, you know, as long as everything went according to plan, that, you know, we would be here today. So it's been cool to see it happen, just because of the way that they're, just, you know, it's sort of the vision, that, you know, it's like Andy Reese always knew that this was going to happen, and it's just a matter of everyone kind of catching up.
And of course, these changes really are going to affect Jeff, because he now goes from being in a position of being one of the team leaders to definitely being one of the workers, a domestique, somebody who's going to support some of these bigger names, and how it makes him feel to be in that support role.
Yeah, it's my initial, you know, my pedigree has always been to be a worker. When I came to this team, I definitely got given a lot of great opportunities to be a leader, and I took them, and I really relished it. It's been great to get to win. You know, it's great to get to win Redlands, and it's great to get to win Tour of Utah, and you know, and all the other great results the team has had, you know, or given to help me achieve, were definitely an honor. But I think in a lot of ways, that also taught me how to be a better, you know, better domestique. So in a way, I think it was a good training for me to kind of get it from that end, you know, see how, if you can help, you know. So now I maybe know better what I can do for Cadel, and better what I can, you know, how I can be a better domestique. And honestly, it's great to win small races in America, but if I can be a part of a team that can win a Grand Tour, and even if it's, you know, obviously not me, I think that would be one of my, you know, prouder achievements in my career. So.
And then finally, if you think about the fact that now, with signing a guy like Cadel Evans, a world champion, does that put additional pressure on Jeff, or is Jeff just the kind of guy who puts more pressure on himself?
Yeah, we're not. You know, the team has got a really good ambiance and a really good kind of, just the way that they approach us and the way they treat us. It's, you know, it's there's a lot of respect, and so there's not a lot of kind of, you know, pressure cooker type of pressure, but there's definitely some. you know, I think that the pressure that's there is just this is my chance or this is our chance. You know, we see this as a lot of us, especially the guys that are, you know, first getting these opportunities, and even the guys that are kind of have taken the risk. You know, like guys that could have been on a pro tour team this year that decided to come. You know, like George or Burkhardt or Berlon. You know, like they're or Cadell. You know, they're taking a risk, and so I think obviously the whole crowd is feeling a lot of, you know, pressure, but also just desire to kind of prove ourselves. You know, and it's already become evident at the camp, just the way, you know, going out and riding in 40-degree pace rain and getting the work done. Everyone seems really focused already at this time of year. So I think, looking forward, I think everybody sees the opportunity and is putting pressure on themselves to be there to achieve it.
And moving from Jeff Lauder now to U.S. road racing champion George Hincapie, we thought that we'd start with asking George why he made the change from Columbia HTC to BMC.
Like you said, I had a great time at Columbia HTC. Made a ton of great friends there. Relationships that will last forever. I mean, we've shared some amazing experiences on the team. You know, we've won Milan San Remo, several stages of the Tour de France, and races really from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. So, and had a lot of fun doing it. And it was a tough decision for me, definitely, to leave there. But I had a great opportunity presented to me by Jim Mockowitz, who I started my career with on Team BMC on Motorola, and now he runs Team BMC, and I really the passion that him and Andy Reese have for the sport and for the brand BMC and for my company Hincapie Sportswear was very appealing to me to be part of that and help Team BMC become a world-class team.
Now, in case you haven't noticed or you haven't heard, Team BMC is riding in kit this year that comes from Hincapie Sports. And yes, that is George's company. And the question was, how exciting is it to be racing in your own brand of clothing? And what kind of input did you have into the design of that clothing for the team?
Yeah, I said earlier, it's a dream come true to race in my own clothing brand. It's been a 6-year process where we've been trying to grow the company, and I kind of made a reference earlier. It was, to me, it's kind of like 1999, where we had the U.S. Postal Service. We're trying to protect the lead of the Tour de France, and here we are, a relatively new team with newcomers. And we all really rose to the occasion, and I feel like our company has done that now this year. I mean, we've really stepped up in quality and fit and performance of the clothing, and I'm really proud to be part of that, and really proud that our company is now becoming a worldwide player. I had a lot of input on the fit. Fit was a big thing for us. We have never done a real pro tour team, and there's so many different body styles and different requirements. So I had a lot of input on that. The design of the team was designed by Andy Reese's company, a Swiss design company. We made it all, and they designed the team kit, the U.S. National Champion kit. I had some say in, and our designers designed that. So they basically gave us free rein on that design, and they made some slight tweaks, but which actually we really enjoyed working with them on that, and I think the final product came out great.
Now, I don't know about you, but when I think of George Hincapie, one of the things that I always think about is Paris-Roubaix and the fact that he has been chasing victory in that event for so many years. It's coming up again soon. Question was, George, how important is Paris-Roubaix to you this year?
It's the most important thing right now. If I win that, I can definitely leave the sport without missing anything.
Short, sweet, and to the point answer, and something I think a lot of us expected. But then the question is, when you've got a team like this, how important are team tactics in races like Paris-Roubaix and Tour of Flanders compared to stage racing, and how different is the suffering in a one-day event as opposed to, say, a 3-week stage race?
They're both very important. They're different in the sense that nothing can go wrong in a one-day race, because it's a one-day race. You can't make up for it the next day. you know, you only got one crack at winning, whereas stage races, you know, you can lose a stage but still win the overall. So there's lots of differences. The suffering is the same. It's you know, Roubaix is a race where you let it all hang out and you have nothing left at the finish. Whereas, you know, Tour de France for 3 week races is a cumulative effect. But it's not like one day where you just put everything you have on the line and you finish the race like Roubaix and you're dead tired for 10 days.
And considering the fact that BMC now has three prominent one-day race specialists, Bayon, Burkhart, and Hincapie, we asked George if he would compare his riding style against those of Bayon and Burkhart, his teammates now on Team BMC.
Which I think is pretty similar. We all have a pretty decent sprint for out of a small group. We all know the roads very well. Bayon's won Tour Flanders, so he's got that up on all of us. But I think we're all very experienced in those races and similar qualities.
And finally, Team Quickstep has really had a stranglehold on the Cobblestone Classics over the last few years. Question is whether or not George and his compatriots at BMC can break that hold in 2010.
I think so. You know, like I said, Bayon's won it, and Burkhart's always up there. Carson Kroon's been top 10 many times in Tour Flanders, top 2 in Amstel Gold Race. It's tough. If Stijn De Volder has a day like he has the last 2 years, and nobody's going to beat him because he was, you know, that much better than everybody. But if not, I think we definitely have a fighting chance.
Next up was the world champion, Cadel Evans. First question to Cadel was, how important is it that you are sort of simpatico with your colleagues on the team, that your personalities fit well together? Is that important for the team, for you, and for team tactics?
I don't think a lot of teams often don't take it as make it such a priority, and obviously, you know, if you like to be with the people you're with. I've only been with the team a short time, so maybe it's too early to tell. But normally, if you like to be with the people you're with, you can work better with them. So we'll see.
Earlier at the training camp, Cadel had talked about Team BMC using sort of a modern approach to professional cycling, and we wanted to know what he meant when he said modern. Was that all about the team chemistry, or was there something else involved?
Modern, I'd say, in open-minded approach. A lot of cycling teams, some still now, have been following traditional training, traditional lead-up, traditional race programs, the same way of doing things. But as I see it now, they're getting left behind in a lot of cycling because, you know, new training, new techniques, technology, etc. It's giving people an advantage, and that's where I think Lance was really changed the way people prepared for the Tour de France, because he took all these other little areas, small areas, but many of them, to a higher level, which, you know, in the end result, you know, came about. And open-minded in the sense that open-minded to new ideas and new thinking, different mentalities and new ideas. I think we're very lucky in BMC, and we're in a situation this year at least. We don't have a guarantee that we'll go to the Tour de France. But at the same time, we're not obliged to do many races, which may not help us do a better Tour de France. And we have less riders, but we have less races. I'd like to see its quality, not quantity.
That last response from Cadel really begged the question, because the team isn't guaranteed to go to the Tour de France, what is his attitude about chasing, and is that a goal for the team, to chase an invite to the Tour de France?
If we really deserve a place and we don't get a start, that would be frustrating. But it's a challenge. I see it as a challenge and something that we have to work together to confront, and that's something, a challenge that I find an interesting challenge, something I'm looking forward to working with the guys here with, and hopefully confronting, combating, and just getting on the start line in good shape.
One of the journalists in attendance asked Cadel that he had heard that some riders have things written into their contracts that say that if their team doesn't get an invite to the Tour de France, that then they would have the opportunity to be a free agent and then go to another team, perhaps to be able to ride the Tour. And what is written into Cadell's contract when it comes to a situation like that?
The only thing I have is if I don't go to the tour, I take my wife on holidays. That's the only agreement I've got with anyone, and that's just with my wife.
It's no secret that Cadell has been known to, well, occasionally have a temper, and we've seen that displayed at the Tour de France in the past. And we commented that it seemed that Cadell seemed perhaps calmer than he has in the past and more at peace. And we wanted to know whether or not that was simply as a result of being on this team and the atmosphere in this team.
Certainly being this team is a lot lower stress levels than in other environments I've been in, and I'm actually a really calm, relaxed guy, but because people only see me at the Tour de France, it's a stressy situation. You shouldn't judge people on that because you're only seeing sort of 2 or 3 minutes or 5 minutes of their life, but I'd say one thing that really impressed me when I very first met with the manager of this team is how well planned and programmed everything was. Everyone knew exactly what their roles were going to be, where they were going, what each individual's... Obviously, you can't plan every rider's day for the entire year because there are uncontrollable circumstances that are going to happen during the year. But everything was so well planned and programmed straight away. I know exactly what I have to do, what I have to concentrate on, and that suits me much better. That's even back in my mountain bike days. I was sort of one who planned and as carefully as I could for everything, obviously, with the end result to try and perform as best as possible. But it leaves you in a much better situation knowing that each day I go out training, whether it's in December or in Australia, I know exactly what I'm doing, what needs to be done, and what little goals and stepping stones I've got along the way. And that's just quality of life on a personal level has been fantastic for me.
And as a follow-up to that answer, we wanted to know, well, Cadell's sort of been known to not have the greatest relationship in the past with the press, and how is he preparing for that in the coming year?
Planning and preparing for things, and that's where George came out to Tour Down Under, which I think was great because we could already start working together and part of my job is being here with you guys, talking to you and passing on information and so on, and that's actually a job, that's actually part of the job that I don't mind, contrary to popular belief. Let's say people aren't quite as well informed as they think they are. But it just at the Tour Down Under there were 600,000 spectators, but there's only one of me. When you got the rainbow jersey, a lot of people want some of your time and so on. So obviously at a certain point, not everyone's going to get the time that they want with you and so on. But it's about being here, and everyone today has their chance to ask a question. I also have the time to think up hopefully what's going to be a precise and insightful answer. And it's just all about being planned and being ready for those things, and that was why for George and me to come out for Tour Down Under, it's all part of that. Being prepared, so hopefully I'll have a bit of time and energy at the tour if I'm in the results, and if we're at the tour, of course, but if I'm in the results and so on, and that's all part of being part of a team and making it all work better for everyone.
Something else Cadell has a reputation for is, well, there's a lot of people who say that he doesn't attack. His tactics aren't there. His strategy's not there. He doesn't seem sometimes to want it. And some of that was evidenced in the Vuelta, in the Tour last year. But then again, he did win the rainbow jersey. And so we wanted to hear what Cadell's comments were about that and the way that people perceive his racing style and how it all came together for the rainbow-striped World Champions jersey.
In summary, I'd say it was a season of perseverance, but perseverance pays, and I think having the rainbow stripes certainly shows that. But I really did everything in 2009 to be as good as I could at the April races in Dauphiné and the Tour, and I did everything wrong. I didn't get sick, I didn't get injured, I did all the training and everything, but just things, just no matter how carefully I would plan and work for them, just weren't coming together and just weren't falling in place. And then the Vuelta was just a perfect example of that. It's like, man, how much more prepared can I be? And for something like that to happen with the puncture and the time loss and all this and that, it became such a ridiculous chain of event. The TV stopped to film it all, and that blocked the traffic for the team car to give it a spare bike, and it was just ridiculous. But then there was only one thing that could have possibly made up for all this, and that was everything going right for me on the day there in Mindrisio, and it did. And that day, for anyone to win a world championship, is very satisfying. But after I think 15 or 16 years of trying for it to finally happen in what's almost my hometown after that year that I had was really just made it so much more worthwhile. And then I suppose on the other side, you know, like going back to the people who are not as well informed as they think they are, I'd say I never attack apparently. I kind of attacked that day and it stuck that time. And yeah, everyone was here to see it and it was successful. It was a big difference in that. But for me personally, I just, you know, I'm just doing what I can in every race that I do and performing what I can. And yeah, there it all came, fell into place and went right for me. But really after the year I'd had and yeah, also I've been there on, you know, mountain bike, on the road and whatever, been there for the win in the worlds and something went wrong. Or something, you know, one year I was there for the with Bettini in Stuttgart yelling in my ear, do this, do that. I know I can't beat Bettini in the finish, but I can't run away from him either. So things like this happen, and you're like, you know, there was a lost world championship or a medal or whatever. But then, yeah, that day it all finally came together.
Back to that question about his reputation as someone who doesn't attack, who doesn't go for it. Where does that come from, and what does Cadell think about it?
I'd say I'm a fairly calculating rider, and one thing that's a little bit of a trap is, well, for me, that a lot of, in the press at least, they talk about, oh, I never attack, I need to be more aggressive and stuff, but for me, it's just making talk, because what my year gets judged by is what position in the past, my year gets judged by what position I finish in the Tour de France, and I don't see the point in attacking people who are stronger than you, who are going to chase you down, or have teammates to chase you down, and then you're only going to get dropped, and that's going to compromise what, you know, and then it's one year that, oh, you only got fourth, and, well, maybe I got second or something like that. That's, you know, I do actually know myself. I've been, you know, living with myself all my life and been racing with my own two legs for 17 or 18 years now, and I have a fair idea what my capabilities are, so you know, I use those as best I can to get the best result I can on the results sheet, and you know, sometimes it works, but more often than not it doesn't. That's the same for everyone.
And with that, our interviews for the BMC 2010 training camp in Agoura, California came to an end. It was a great time being able to interview some of these extremely famous names as they take what has been a great team and make it even greater in 2010. I think a lot of people have high hopes and high expectations for Team BMC in the coming year. We will see as these one-day classics approach how they do, whether or not George Hincapie or Marcus Burkhardt or Alessandro Bayon are going to have the glory that they're seeking for Team BMC in those events. And then, of course, how the team will do in the Giro, the Tour of California, and whether they are going to get an invite to the Tour de France. And if so, whether or not Cadel Evans or indeed George Hincapie will have the ride of their life. We will know soon enough. But it was great that Bicycle.net was able to go to the 2010 BMC training camp and bring that audio to all of us. Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the Fredcast. Once again, I want to thank our sponsors, Jensen USA. You can go to jensenusa.com/thefredcast to get some great deals on some great products. Jensen USA is one of the premier internet and mail order companies in the bicycle industry, and I am so pleased to have them here supporting the Fredcast, and I hope that you will support them. Also want to thank Epic Planet and encourage you to go out and get the Fredcast Epic Tucson bundle, and you will find that at epicplanet.tv/Fredcast_bundle, or just go to the show notes at www.thefredcast.com and click on the links there. And finally, don't forget to sign up for the Fredcast Tour of the French Alps, the Chasseurs de Col Tour, the Col Chasers, August 21st through the 28th, 2010. Go to www.vivatravels.com and sign up today for that tour or any of their tours. But in any case, make sure you let them know that you heard about it right here on the Fredcast. And of course, thank you all for your donations and for supporting the other sponsors at www.thefredcast.com. Now, to stay in touch with the show, of course, you can send an email at any time to thefredcast@gmail.com. You can call the Fredcast listener hotline at area code 661-513-FRED, area code 661-513-3733, or follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/Fredcast, and of course our website, www.thefredcast.com. And to end the show, as always, it's time for PodSafe Cycling Music. This week's music coming to us from the PodSafe Music Network at music.mevio.com. Tonight's music is by Anthony Rankin, and it's called Moving Forward. There are links in the show notes to where you can find Anthony on Mevio, his own website, and where you can find this song and Anthony on iTunes. That's going to do it for this week's episode of the Fredcast. It's going to be 2 weeks before we have another episode of the Fredcast, so keep that in mind. It's just my travel schedule and personal schedule, but we will be back in 2 weeks with another episode of the Fredcast. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for staying subscribed. Thank you for supporting our sponsors. And thank you for being a part of the Fredcast community. Between this show and the next, enjoy the music, but most of all, enjoy the ride.
On my back, I got a bed to sleep in, but I can't keep track of all the nights I've lost in you and all the fights in which we find the truth. Now I ain't blind and I ain't stupid. I may be young, but I can prove it now. Am I moving forward or just running in place? What's half a beat and leaves no saving grace? Well, I got silver and gold, I got more of the same. I got heat in the cold like a fire in the rain that falls at night and hits your window, voice in the light like a whisper on a pillow. Then you're lost in your dreams again. Saving grace.